This is Johnny Gould's Jewish State. The world is listening.
John Ware is the BBC Panorama documentary maker who took on the Corbynites and won. His 2019 documentary, Is Labour Anti-Semitic?, aired on BBC One, launched 3 long years of bitter legal struggle. It's unusual for a journalist to sue for defamation, but everything was at stake for John, from his own reputation to the pursuit of journalistic process. So John sued the Labour Party, Jewish Voice for Labour, and even a fellow journalist, Paddy French, and with great fortitude and resilience, won through.
Paddy French suggested the fact that my wife and children, who happen to be Jewish, might have been a breach of the BBC impartiality guidelines. I don't know how he worked that out, but that was the suggestion he made.
I think that's probably one of the most disgusting slurs there could be.
Well, certainly the judge, Justice Knowles, I think he said something like, I find this particularly distasteful.
Yes.
And I'm glad he did make the point, because it is. And he said no credible or reputable journalist could possibly have thought that, you know, my family's faith had any relevance to the
accuracy. Distasteful is the word.
Yeah.
It's not entirely over. John needs to collect the damages from those who defamed him, and Al Jazeera produced what he sees as a one-sided segment in a documentary on Corbyn's Labour years, which vilifies a young man by the name of Luke Stanger.
Selective journalism. Journalism.
We'll highlight that in this episode too. He's not earned a penny for 12 months. Defamation is a harrowing weight on one's mind, not to mention the headspace one needs to keep up with the news as a working journalist. But he's back on the saddle and preparing to make another Panorama documentary on Brexit. Find out how much the legal process cost those who defamed him, and who they were.
John Ware, for the second time, welcome to Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Good to be here, Johnny.
I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you back, especially in the heightened time of our first interview. My first question to you back then was, how do you feel? You said, I'm confident.
Mm.
And your confidence was vindicated.
I fought 3 cases. 3 defamation cases. It's unusual for a journalist to do that, but the defamation was so serious and there was a principle at stake, and I wasn't going to back down, and I won all 3. So I'm still full of feathers.
Excellent. Now, This is, as you say, it's unusual for a journalist to sue for defamation, but this was everything. This was reputation. But this was about mainstream journalism. This was about rigorous pursuit of journalism for its purpose. So in suing the Labour Party, in suing Jewish Voice for Labour, and a fellow journalist called Paddy French, the stakes really were they the biggest in your life, in your career?
I don't know about that. Certainly the longest spell of litigation that I've been involved in. I mean, it spanned pretty much 3 years and has dominated my life. I can honestly say I haven't earned a penny since last January, about 12 months now. Because litigation, it's seamless. And, lawyers are very creative people. And you start out thinking, how can I lose? What the Labour Party said is not true, that I'd set out to deceive. It's never crossed my mind to deceive anyone in journalism. I'm not in the propaganda business. It offends every bone in my body. The JVL said, that I had a long record of racism, Islamophobia, and that I was engaged in the far right. Categorically untrue. Mm. I've made programs against the far right. Mm. And this fellow, Paddy French, said that I'd actually set out to help stop Corbyn becoming Prime Minister. That was my motive. Well, I'm actually not displeased that Mr. Corbyn is not Prime Minister. I'm pretty displeased that Johnson was Prime Minister as well, as it happens.
Perfect balance.
No, but it's true. I mean, the idea that that was my motive is just, yeah. I mean, preposterous. Mm-hmm. We had a story, you know, we had a story. It was nothing to do with fixing elections. The BBC doesn't do that stuff. So, you know, there was a principle at stake, but it wasn't just that. It was the underbelly of this was, you know, demeaning genuine anxieties within the Jewish community, belittling their concerns. It was all part and parcel of that. And particularly with the French case, I know what was going on with French and his supporters. It was to use the courts to refight all the complaints that have been made about the programme in the hope of rehabilitating Mr. Corbyn's reputation. And that was really what it was about.
And let's just explain Paddy French. He is the pro-Corbyn publisher of a website called Press Gang, exposing what he calls rogue journalism. And French launched a defamatory campaign exposing your dirty tricks to deliberately deceive millions of viewers by knowingly exaggerating the scale of anti-Semitism in Labour under Jeremy Corbyn. Some of the quotes, this is the sort of chat we're talking about. Where is a rogue scumbag who, along with Zionist anti-socialist interlopers in Labour, need exposing for the frauds that they are? It's the programme, is Labour anti-Semitic, was disgraceful, scurrilous, black propaganda, bad use of the word there, and the national broadcaster, the BBC, who put it to air, should have also been sued. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in it. I don't really want to read all of this, but you get the impression, dear listener.
I just, in fairness, French didn't use all of those words. Those were the sort of adjectives that donors to his campaign used, to be fair to French, although French did use ludicrous language. I mean, he said that I'd bent the truth to breaking point and that sort of stuff, but he didn't use any of that sort of foul language. Actually, that was pretty tame. There's a lot worse than that.
Well, I could read more, but I want people to keep listening.
Yeah.
Now, also, you went for Jewish Voice for Labour, which is a bunch of people who I was exposed to at Parliament Square. I just happened to be at the back of the protest, and they were deliberately agitating Jewish people, and it was one of the most depressing standoffs. It wasn't violent. It was just horrible shouting of words, really, really disgusting discourse on the streets of London in front of the Parliament. And Naomi Wimborne Idrissi told 1.4 million BBC listeners that your journalism included right-wing racist work and that you'd engaged in Islamophobia, extreme far-right politics, as a consequence of which the BBC had to apologise for your conduct. There really is only one way that you could take this.
I mean, there wasn't a word of truth in any of that, as ultimately Jewish Voice for Labour had to concede and made a formal apology in court. But you see, at the heart of this, Johnny, is this. I think a lot of these people do see themselves as incredibly kind of progressive, sort of brimful of moral rectitude. And this is how I see their reflex to anyone who challenges their political orthodoxy. Because the reflex, certainly in each of these cases, was to just not play the ball, but play the man and impugn malign motives. You know, I disagree with this, therefore he must have set out to deceive. He must be lying. It couldn't just be, I fundamentally disagree with the arguments you presented. I think they're rotten. I think they're, you know, whatever. But they go almost as a reflex, that extra stage, by impugning motive. And that, and here's the point. All of them, the people who put out the Labour Party statement saying that I'd invented quotes and all that, Wimborne Idrissi herself said, so she said, was an experienced journalist before she became active in the JVL. She said she worked for Reuters, apparently. And then, you know, there's Paddy French, who describes himself as a very experienced investigative journalist. They're all journalists. The most basic rule, or at least the most basic rule I learned in journalism, mainstream journalism, is that you simply don't get into people's motives, what's in their heads, unless you can prove it.
Mm.
I just, you know, I've had so much of this stuff on social media ever since I've been making programs about extremism of one sort or another. Yeah. And I just thought, well, I'm not having this anymore.
John, as we know, the cost of justice, the cost of litigation is extremely severe. How much are the Corbynites down and how many cases have there been?
Well, the Corbynites are down, by my estimation, approaching £6 million in legal costs and awards, give or take. That's my estimate so far of what I count as having lost 17 out of 23 cases. The majority of them, the vast majority of them, relating to defamation and anti-Semitism related. And there are still a number of cases yet to be resolved. So it will not surprise me if the final bill, of course, wait to see who wins these outstanding cases, but if the trend continues, Corbynites are going to find themselves severely out of pocket. A lot of this relates to social media. And as Mark Lewis, who acted for me, quite rightly says, people need to wake up. Social media has, as he put it, made everybody a publisher, unhampered by the shackles of an editor. And he's quite right. Just because you tweet doesn't in some way absolve you of, relieve you of your obligations, any breaches of the defamation laws. Tweeting is like publishing a book or a newspaper. And people need to get wise to this. And it would be, I think, a healthy thing if everybody could think before they tweet.
Mm.
It's been a very costly, the Corbyn era has been extremely costly in litigation alone.
Are you playing catch-up with Johnny Gould's Jewish State? I've had the pleasure of some really great guests recently. Here's Jonathan Friedland on The Escape Artist, the life story of Rudolf Werber, who as a young man escaped Auschwitz.
He pointed an accusing finger at people who I think we all would rather were not part of the accused. So I think there is a comfortable way of telling the Second World War story, which is all evil resided in Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler and the Germans and the Nazis, and everyone else was on the side of good, meaning the Allies, the United States, Britain, everybody else. Now, that's not true. It's more complicated.
It can't be.
It can't be.
And Hillel Neuer, whose UN Watch keeps check on the excesses and mission creep of the UN human rights in Geneva.
The challenges are great. They're not going away. I am concerned by the cultural revolution that we've experienced in America in the past 5 years, known to some as the woke revolution, where there's a kind of a McCarthyism. If you say something, it could be canceled and fired from your university, from your corporation, from a journalist. And often it's an anti-liberalism. So that, to be honest, really, really scares me, because we need our democracies to be healthy, to be honest, to be truth tellers. So I am deeply concerned.
If you like Johnny's regular podcasts, think about making a donation at either patreon.com/Johnny Gould or buy him a coffee. He loves coffee. ko-fi.com/Johnny Gould.
You touched on the fault line of progressive ideas, and that is that the pursuit of something perfect makes that person absolute in their view, so that anyone who takes on any aspect of that so-called progressive nature must be nefarious.
Yeah.
And therein lies the fault line with extreme progressive politics.
Well, these were people, I think, determined to destroy my reputation, but also, and really more importantly, in dismissing the programme's message that a serious anti-Semitism problem had developed within Labour under Corbyn, It also had the effect of belittling and demeaning many Jews within the party and making them feel unwanted, because the crisis wasn't just about classic examples of anti-Semitism, you know, the sort of gratuitously offensive stuff like, you know, Rothschilds run the world, Israel controls British political parties and other sort of idiotic, you know, conspiracy theories like that. More widely, it was about the way many Jews in, or Jews in some Labour Party branches and CLPs had become discomforted, anxious even, about a sense of being barely tolerated unless they demonstrated themselves to be anti-Zionists. So there was indeed a mood created in the party, as you know, Len McCluskey once remarked, although what he meant was, you know, he used it to play down the idea of a crisis. What I mean is that it was not a very nice mood that was developing in parts of the party. You know, a party that otherwise asserts anti-racism at its core. And yet, while asserting that I had deliberately exaggerated the scale of the problem, some of my fiercest critics postured as the sort of high priests of proper, decent journalism. But when I actually looked at some of the arguments they used and some of the evidence they cited in support of their case that anti-Semitism had been exaggerated, and, for example, there'd been little or no interference by Corbyn and his office in, you know, in disciplinary cases, in my view, their journalism was at times really lacking in integrity. Some of it was just awful. And, you know, it felt like a concerted attempt to rewrite history about the Corbyn years.
Now, I've seen you a few times in the intervening years, and you'd won some cases, and I thought that might be the end of it, that you could pursue life afterwards. But actually then came Paddy French, and that was the most stressful, the most difficult one, wasn't it? The last one.
Yes, I think it was. Yes, it was, really, because, I mean, the JVL was frustrating because, you know, for a while they insisted that I had, you know, that I was a racist and I was, you know, and the BBC had apologised and all that. And eventually they realised that actually they couldn't prove that. So they tried a whole lot of other defences. As I say, the lawyers can be very creative. But eventually they just said, look, can we settle this? And being a reasonable person, I said, okay, and we did. French, you're right, was more stressful. What I and my lawyers felt was overwhelming evidence, he just kept batting on. And I think it was, and he said, you know, we need a trial, we need to settle these issues in the forensic setting of a court. And my response was, sure, well, that's exactly what I want, but you're going to lose, I think. And if you're sensible, you'll settle. I don't actually want a lot of money from you, whatever the initial claim is. What I really do want is a proper apology. You know, he just wouldn't do it. And eventually he had to concede that he, like the JVL, he couldn't actually prove what he had said. His truth defence collapsed, and his lawyers got in touch with mine and said, okay, we can't prove this, but we're going to continue on other defences, in his case, public interest. And we said, well, if that's what you want to do, okay, but we're going to fight that too. And on and on and on it went, until right at the last moment, he basically bottled it and said, well, I'm not going to come to court. I can't actually. I've been deprived of the right to, of the means with which to defend myself properly, which is just preposterous. And the judge made it clear it was a ludicrous response. And I think shamed French. I think he emerges from this as a diminished individual who was frankly rather cowardly.
But you haven't worked for 12 months either. I mean, and apart from anything, this doesn't just focus your mind on the case. This affects your whole life. Mm. How's life been in the goldfish bowl?
Well, it has, you know, it's litigation it's not for the faint-hearted.
It's in your head all the time.
Absolutely, it's in your head all the time. And no detail is too small. You know, lawyers grind exceeding small. One of the ways in which I think French and his lawyers, Bindman's, trying to do grind me down was that they sent me something called a Part 18 request, which in old money used to be called Better and Further Particulars. And there were something like 87 questions. Mm. And these weren't sort of what were you wearing when you filmed. It was set out, you know, things like set out what you intended to do, set out who did what conclusions you drew, why you drew them, what you know, and so on. It was intended to just make me feel, look, I can't be going on with this.
No.
But instead, I thought, well, okay, if that's what you want to do, you'll get the answers. And I sent back something like 170 pages, answering every question. I wasn't going to let them demoralise me. Anyway, as I
that's
say, we prevailed.
That is the hidden subtext to these fights. Mm. The attempt to grind you down and present weakness, and all you have to do is just to keep going. I understand that when you're on the defence.
Well, it costs money too.
Costs money, of course.
A lot of money.
And you funded yourself, not the BBC.
Absolutely not the BBC. I mean, there's all these myths that the BBC funded me. They did not. That I own the Jewish Chronicle because I was briefly part of the consortium to stop it going into liquidation.
Don't own the Jewish Chronicle.
I do not own the Jewish
Chronicle. You don't own this podcast.
I do not own this podcast. I have never had any financial or managerial role in the Jewish Chronicle ever. There are just so many nonsense.
They'll say anything, won't they?
You just can't deal with them all.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And the BBC didn't fund me. I was on an insurance deal if I lost, but it's not quite as simple as that.
No.
Believe me, this has cost me quite a lot of money out of my own pocket, and certainly I am potentially liable for several hundred thousand pounds if we don't recover them from Paddy French. So
you have been awarded damages, though, significant.
I've been awarded damages, but that, you know, being awarded them and actually getting them are two quite different things.
How can you secure them?
Well,
and how much are they?
There's no guarantee I will. I mean, this is the risk I took. I mean, people kept saying, you know, where's funded? Where's got this? I mean, they don't know what they're talking about.
So how does this get someone?
This has been a very significant risk for me. I'm not a rich man. You don't get rich working at the BBC, I can tell you.
So, apart from if you can, Gary Lineker, of course.
Right, yes.
Him. What way can you get the award out of someone like Paddy French?
Well,
have you got? Can you put a charge on his house? How does it
work?
Well,
we're getting a cost order.
Yes.
I'm pretty confident the judge will order it. We'll deliver a cost order. The court will. And, you know, he'll be required to start paying my legal costs. Mm-hmm. Now, he will, I'm sure, say he hasn't got the money. He's already said that. We'll see where we go.
Yeah.
So this is not over, you know? This is not over. And if there's a big shortfall between what we recover from him and my costs, then, you know, I'm going to have to find the money from somewhere. So, you know, this has not been easy.
On the positive side,
yeah,
you have been fully vindicated.
Mm.
Your journalistic career is
well,
back
not
on
in
track.
The eyes of the Corbynites, Johnny. They,
yeah, but
they,
you know,
they nothing. You know, they're like sort of Daleks. They just keep
okay. They keep on at it, but they have been legally vanquished.
Yeah.
How's work? What next for John Ware?
Well, I haven't done any work apart from.
No, but now you're clear to do it.
Well, I'm pleased to say the BBC. A couple of weeks ago asked me if I'd like to do something on Brexit, and as it happens, I really would like to do something on Brexit.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to start a panorama on Brexit shortly. It certainly won't... the remuneration, I can tell you, will pay a fraction of my legal costs, but still it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's important that you get back on the saddle.
Yeah, no, I...
That's,
I
as important as anything.
Sure, no, look, I've been down this foxhole for... too long. And, you know, it's not a healthy place because, you know, you can't miss anything. And I've had to keep abreast of quite a lot of the social media, which is horrible.
Mm.
It's a sewer. It's revolting.
Mm.
And a lot of the kind of Corbynite echo chambers, these sort of rather sort of sad, you know, politically marginal groups are now kind of talking to themselves, and it's an unhealthy place to be because there's just so much poison and anger mm-hmm. and pent up, you know, righteousness. And you just want to get out and breathe some fresh air. You know, the thing that kept buzzing in my head as I was doing this, you know, when I go to the next stage, is this really what I want to do? There's an American Supreme Court judge who said, "Only a fool litigates." And that phrase just kept pinging around my head.
Yes. Was there ever a point where you thought, "Oh God, I'm not going to win this," or you thought, "What have I done?"
Well,
but then you wouldn't have worked again, you know, if you wouldn't have been a big, brave to take this on.
Well, once I, you know, opened fire, I wasn't going to pull back. Whatever happened, and defamation does turn into a sort of big boys poker game at some level, and it certainly did with me.
Mm-hmm. Should we name the Corbyn cheerleaders who use the media against you? Just actually name these people.
Well, there are so many, but the principal ones: Novara Media,
mm-hmm.
Aaron Bastani. There was a woman articles editor, I can't think of her, and Charlotte someone, who wrote a lot of nonsense. There was a lecturer in journalism called Dr. Justin Schlossberg. He was obsessed, I would say. I mean, he just couldn't stop battering away. There was, more recently, there's been Al Jazeera, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The former Telegraph Mail commentator Peter Oborne, moved over to Middle East Eye. Quite a change in Peter's career, I'd say. I don't know, lots of others.
Now here's a great stat. Jewish Voice for Labour claimed that if you're Jewish, you're 6.2 times more likely to be accused of anti-Semitism than if you're not Jewish. I wonder how you'd measure that. Is that really true? I can tell you from anecdotal evidence, I've never been called an anti-Semite.
No.
I've been called other things, but I can honestly tell you, no one has ever, even in jest, called me an anti-Semite.
Well, yes, I mean, that claim needs unpacking. Of course, on its... you know, and it's a very bare claim,
and
it's on its face is nonsense. But what it actually, as I understand it, means there are over six times as many people who are Jewish who have been or are in the process of being disciplined for matters relating to anti-Semitism. Now, that doesn't mean that they've said something which is anti-Semitic. What it actually means in the vast majority of cases, this is as I understand it anyway from those dealing with the complaints, is that, and it applies mainly to Jewish Voice for Labour, of course it doesn't apply to, you know, mainstream Jews in the Labour Party, it applies only to Jewish Voice for Labour, or mainly, almost exclusively, to those members who have chosen to platform or in some way support
yes.
organisations like Labour Against the Witch Hunt,
yes.
which have been whose purpose is to belittle and diminish the idea of anti-Semitism having been a problem in the Labour Party. That's a Starmer zero tolerance decision. And
near zero tolerance.
Well, all right, near zero. Well,
how's he doing?
How's he doing on anti-Semitism?
Yeah.
I think he's made the right calls, yes. Personally.
He hasn't finished yet, though, has he?
I mean, no, there's work to be done, yeah. Further downstream.
Yeah.
I think his front bench is pretty decent now. But certainly there are remain problems within the party, but it's in a better, much better shape than I would say than it was, to be fair, to Starmer.
They're back under a stone, John. They're not gone.
I don't think they're under a stone. I think
that's kind of what you do with anti-Semites. You can't eradicate anti-Semitism. It's not possible. But you can do is stick them back under a stone.
No, well, it's kind of in the soil, as one of my colleagues told me.
Yeah. So you have written in a number of op-eds and articles in the intervening years about how the Corbynites are trying to rewrite history. This is what you regard as the Corbynites and their supporters in the alt media, I think, for want of a better word, seeing what they can do. And they persist in claiming that anti-Semitism has been exaggerated. They claim that the leaked Labour report vindicates Corbyn and his office and shows that Panorama's whistleblowers and officials in Labour's HQ were responsible for not dealing with the crisis. Mm. And these Corbynites still claim that the EHRC vindicated Corbyn and his office because it showed that most interventions by Corbyn's office were to speed up disciplinary action. But the EHRC report did actually not say that. Again, this is an example of them attempting to re-quote, to reinvent what's out there in black and white.
You're right. There have been one or two members of, certainly I think, Mr. Corbyn's one of his speechwriters has said that it was mainly, to the extent that there was interference, it was mainly about speeding up cases rather than preventing action or against Corbyn's political allies. I may have missed it, but I nowhere in the EHRC report can I find a finding that most interference related to speeding up cases. I may have missed it, but I have not found it. There's a fellow called Richard Sanders who produced one of the Al Jazeera programs. He says the same thing. I don't know where he gets his evidence from. But what the EHRC does say, however, about interference is that it was quotes extensive. At least it was more extensive than Corbyn's office interference by Corbyn's office in other disciplinary cases. And all I can say is that this has been one of the areas of deep division, certainly between me and my critics. They persist in asserting that there was little or no interference. And they do rely on the leaked report to say that. And they do rely on, the more recent report by Martin Ford, KC, to say that. Again, so far as the leaked report is concerned, it is an interesting document, but on interference, it completely avoids the evidence.
Mm.
That he's staring them in the face sometimes about interference. As far as Martin Ford is concerned, he does find that there was interference. He finds that it wasn't, from the documents he's seen, he says, he doesn't believe that interference was systemic, but he does find it was most notably, I think are his words, in relation to Corbyn's own allies.
Mm-hmm.
But he also finds the evidence that's been given to him by officials from Labour Party HQ is that so much of the attempts by Corbyn's office to interfere were verbal, not written down.
Mm.
And therefore he can't reach a finding on that because there's no documentation. But I have certainly seen very detailed submissions which haven't been published to the EHRC from officials which I would regard as very credible. I do regard them as very credible. I know even people in Corbyn's office regard them as credible, whatever they may say about other officials in the McNichol era, where this individual talks about there being a significant number of attempts to interfere with disciplinary matters. There is one case above all which the Corbynites, or at least my critics, I should say, fasten on, which they claim demonstrate that Corbyn's office was trying to speed things along, and that relates to Mr. Corbyn's closest ally, Ken Livingstone. Honestly, the evidence shows totally the opposite. Mm. They are relying on one attempt by a decent soul in Corbyn's office, one Laura Murray, who I think was genuinely trying to improve things. And Laura Murray did get on to the officials and say, what's happening with Ken Livingstone? You know, can we get on with, you know, the Jewish community are very concerned that there appears to be a delay. However, the critical decision was taken, or attempt was taken, by Corbyn himself. This has not been published officially, but I've seen the evidence and I've put it to Corbyn and he has not denied it. And the evidence is that shortly before he was due to appear before the first stage of the disciplinary process, this is in relation to him repeating his offensive comments about Hitler, about German Zionists collaborating with Nazis and so on. Yeah. Shortly before he was due to appear before the disputes panel of the NEC, a very senior member, a senior member of the governance team, get a call from two of Corbyn's closest aides, Carrie Murphy, his chief of staff, and Seamus Milne. And they want to explore, on behalf of Jeremy himself, is there anything you can do for Ken? Ken's very important to Jeremy. You know, he's very important to the left. And essentially the message was, you know, can we get this to go away in some way? Now, the officials said no in the end, and that was ultimately why Ken Livingstone resigned. But there was an attempt by his office to get these charges, dropped, finessed away.
Yeah.
That is interference, no question.
It now continues, it goes on, John. In September of 2022, the Qatari state-owned Al Jazeera news channel transmitted a four-part series called The Labour Files, and at its heart was the assertion, and again we've heard this before, that Jeremy Corbyn was undermined by a smear campaign orchestrated by the right wing in Labour, and that the scale of Labour anti-Semitism was exaggerated, and the focus on anti-Semitism had actually created a hierarchy of racism within Labour that actually discriminated further against Black, Asian and Muslim members. John, what do you think of that?
Well, I should, from the outset, declare an interest when I talk about Al Jazeera. They were very critical of Panorama. But that said, I think their approach to journalism is, in this case anyway, is quite problematic, actually. There's a case, for example, in two sections in Programme One on a young Labour Party activist called Luke Stanger, activist in the sense that he was active against anti-Semitism. Now, Stanger, they portray Stanger essentially as a sort of high-level operative, essentially part of a conspiracy to undermine Corbyn and take over Labour, someone who mercilessly harassed anti-Zionists and also who was engaged in sending death threats to one anti-Zionist. I've looked at this in some depth because Stanger has been grievously hurt by these allegations. And, you know, I've done quite a lot of stuff on miscarriages of justice, and you get a sense, and I used to present the BBC's Rough Justice series, and, you know, you get a sense of when people are genuine and when they're not. And I've talked at length to Stanger. I think he's a credible individual. He acknowledges that many of his attacks on anti-Zionists were overly belligerent, but that is really where the truth of this story, in my view, ends, so far as the way Al Jazeera did. What Al Jazeera doesn't do, there are several key omissions. If this subject had been approached in a sort of conventional mainstream way, you'd have put both sides of the story on the table. And when you do that, a very different story emerges. And I'll give you an example. Al Jazeera focus only on Stanger's attacks on anti-Zionists. There is nothing about the attacks that the anti-Zionists made on Stanger. Nothing at all. And that is significant because the attacks that they launched on Stanger were venomous.
Yes.
I mean, really venomous.
Visceral.
Personally, visceral. You know, he was, he was an imbecile. He was a village idiot. There was a kind of an attempt to portray him as some sort of, you know, sexual predator. They turned this idea of his abuse, alleged abuse against them by criticizing their anti-Zionism, as an abuser of women. There was a reference, I think, to Savile. I wouldn't want him near my children. They nicknamed him Lurky. You get it?
Yeah,
it's all very smeary stuff. Horrible. And he's a young lad. These are mainly late middle-aged critics. He's a young lad, you know. He was recently out of university. He had a lot of mental health issues. He was an anxious fellow. He suffered from depression. Very bright boy. But, you know, they were just cruel. You know, cruel. That's the first point. You didn't get any of that in Al Jazeera. But going on to the death threat point, in a way more serious charge that Al Jazeera make against Luke Stanger is that he was involved in sending death threats to this anti-Zionist campaigner. Now, this anti-Zionist campaigner turns out to be a barrister who's been disbarred for dishonesty. He also has got a dreadful record, in my view, of he's also tweeted some really hateful stuff, you know, gratuitously offensive about the state of Israel and Zionists. Zionists worked hand in hand with Nazis to send these innocent Jews to their death. Zionists then worked to establish the racist state of Israel. Here's another one. Jimmy Savile was an Israeli supporter and a devout Zionist. Zionists wallow in victimhood to justify their brutality. Nazis did the same following World War II, and so on. I mean, this is just gratuitous stuff. This is beyond legitimate criticism of Zionism, if you want to criticize it. It's just gratuitously offensive. There is absolutely no evidence at all, and I've looked at this quite carefully, that Luke Stanger was in any way was involved in sending death threats to this ex-barrister, this disbarred barrister. In a way worse, this issue had been looked at by the Labour Party disciplinary team, and Stanger had made it perfectly clear that he wasn't involved, and not only that, that he totally, even though he objected to, you know, very strongly to this individual's anti-Semitic tweets, obviously, he would never have engaged in sending death threats to this individual. And he regarded them as horrible, which indeed they were. Now, Al Jazeera claims that it has access to the Labour Party's disciplinary files. And my problem with Al Jazeera is if that is the case, they would have had access to Stanger's categorical denial of any involvement in this case. And they should have reported that he denied it. But there is no denial of it in the programme. And I'm simply saying that if, and as I say, there are lots of parts of the programme that Al Jazeera's claims that I can't talk about because I'm not aware. But if this is any guide to their approach, to their, you know, standards applied to making this programme, then I think it raises a lot of questions. I really do. And I'm not a lawyer, but I think Stanger might well have a defamation case against Al Jazeera, frankly.
As someone who's just emerged from that, would you recommend it for him?
Well, that's another matter. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not sure.
John, the purpose of the podcast today was to set the record straight, to record at the end of this very difficult chapter in your life, a vindication that you were confident about at the beginning, and to quote Martin Luther King, to remind us that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice to those people, both Jewish and non-Jewish, who fought Corbyn and his cheerleaders, that it is worth it. It is a difficult road. And from myself and all our listeners here at Johnny Gould's Jewish State, thank you very much for all that you've done.
Well, okay, Johnny, thank you. But, you know, it's not just about me. It was also about trying to set the record straight about the genuine discomfort and anxiety experienced by many Jewish members of the party as a consequence of a noxious atmosphere that had seeped in to the party, and which, you know, most of us thought could never happen in any British political party for very obvious historical reasons. So, sure, obviously, I'm pleased to be vindicated and, you know, getting a judgment from a judge, because that's what I wanted. I mean, these allegations about me and about the programme, about the BBC, came so thick and so fast, you could rebut them until the cows came home. No one, it made no difference, none. So, we'll do this in court. We'll do it in front of a judge, see how we get on. And I got a great judgment from a judge. And, you know, that was terrific. It's a great feeling. And, you know, I don't think my critics will think I've been vindicated at all. But in the eyes of most reasonable people, you know, I have been vindicated. So that's good enough for me.
The best guests and their most heartfelt views, a relay of their missions to a worldwide audience. Hi, it's Johnny again, just popping in at the end of this one. 100 episodes along, and I'm proud that it's fast become the podcast of record. This is coverage of the Jewish and Israeli worlds that just doesn't get properly aired in mass media, and I'm not ashamed to ask for your help. A one-off donation is always gratefully received to support my efforts, but a monthly donation really gets our service off the ground. Your donation can also be made with gift aid, and it's so easy to do. Just click on this, donorbox.org/JG podcast. That's donorbox.org/JG podcast. Are you in? Please share my series with your friends, and thank you for listening.
Johnny Gould's Jewish State is supported by UK Tur Emet, promoting philanthropy.